When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Professor of History Philip Haberkern joins me. Phil is Professor of History at Boston University, MA at University of Virginia and Harvard Divinity School, PhD at Virginia, postdoc at Princeton, now at Boston University. Check out Phil's book, Patron, Saint, and Prophet, Jan Hus in the Bohemian and German Reformation. Phil and I both have a background in religious studies and made the shift to history, so you get to hear us talk shop about that. But of course, this is primarily a conversation about Tyrion and his exchange with the unfortunately oblivious Lancel Lannister. This was my very first conversation with Phil, and sometimes you have these first conversations and realize, oh, like, this guy is immediately a good friend. That's kind of how I felt about my conversation with Phil. So anyway, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I hope you enjoy it too. Without further ado, here is Dr. Philip Haberkern. And you made the shift from religious studies to medieval studies.
Yeah. Well, yeah, technically, I mean, just my PhD is just straight up in history.
Okay.
So, and that was very much a pragmatic move. I had a wonderful mentor when I was in div school who kind of was looking at my interests and was like, for the job market, you should get a PhD in history, but you need to be thoughtful about where you go, because there are going to be certain institutions that are more friendly to the kind of history you do. Uh-huh. And so I ended up at the University of Virginia, where I think every member of my committee was joint appointed in religious studies and history. So it didn't feel unnatural. So it worked out really well, but thankful for that advice along the way.
I wish I would have gotten that advice at some point. It's one thing to be overqualified for any, like, mm-hmm. like when I was on the job market, I was applying to, like, for every like one academic post, I was applying for like four pizza parlors, mm-hmm. and not doing well in either pursuit.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to be overqualified in academia, but to be overqualified in religious studies in academia,
I mean, right?
It's just like, you must hate employment.
Anyway. I got very lucky, and you know, I remember this is the one interview I got the year I went on the job market, because I did it in sort of a limited way, and it turned out that the chair of the search committee, you know, really liked the two sentences in my cover letter about a prospective second project, which 13 years later still has not materialized, but I don't think they can go back and take the job away. Things happen along the way. And unfortunately, I've learned that I write, you know, I'm faster than George Martin, but not much. Uh-huh. And I guess he writes a lot, just not what we want him to. He's probably the same is true of me.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Now, I have to ask.
Yes.
You've got on your Zoom image looks like a Czech reformer.
That is Jan Hus. Yes.
Okay.
Burned at the stake in 1415. That's... I wrote my
first... That
was
a great year to be burned at the stake.
Great year. Fantastic year. So I wrote about him after he dies, was my first book. And it's about commemoration and how it looks different in the Bohemian lands versus particularly in the Lutheran tradition.
Very good. Very good. Now, Phil, I'm kind of interested in... I mean, I'm always excited to read Tyrion chapters, but I'm kind of interested in sort of a general... question about the medieval world. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, who has the power between the queen regent and the king's hand?
It's such a good question because it's sort of central, right? When Lancel comes into the room and he wants to make the distinction between the regent who rules and the hand who serves. And one of the things I'm always struck by in the world of thrones is how informal a lot of the institutions are. And so it's almost less about the office and the person who's exercising it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, historically, there are a lot of analogs for this as well, where particularly, say, in the 15th century, if we were in the world of the Italian Renaissance, where you have, you know, these sort of warlord princes who are often away doing their work as mercenaries, and they leave their wives behind to rule in their stead as regents. And some of them are incredibly competent, incredibly capable. And so in those moments, it would be the analog of Circe, who's clearly ruling. Whereas in others, you might have a senior advisor, a courtier who steps in if there's a different balance, we might say, of sort of expertise or confidence. So I think it shifts depending in that sort of back and forth between Circe and Tyrion for who's actually ruling via control of the king or tight ties with the sort of small council. I think it's ever shifting here. And that's the fun of it for Martin, is leaving the relationship ambiguous.
It really does sort of focus in on what Martin has said is one of the key themes that he's interested in. And that is, you know, where does power reside, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And especially, you know, in this scene, it's so wonderful because Lancel comes in and tries to flex his power, physical, by his rank as a knight, by his wispy mustache. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't work. But, you know, he comes in and tries to set himself up as the dominant figure. And, you know, both in the book, but it's even more visible in the show, there's just a lot of posturing and body language. Uh-huh. And yet, you know, Tyrion so deftly reverses that power dynamic.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see him sort of relishing that at the end of the chapter as he recognizes he has this thing he's longed for. So it's so, I don't know, it's delightful. And Circe sort of looms in the background of this chapter. She's not present.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I have my own questions about her motivation with the relationship with Lancel. Like, is this purely pleasure? Is this sort of grooming a cat's paw? Like, I think there are a lot of, you know, how deliberate is she being and using her own vehicle for power, which in this case is her body, you know, to sort of distance herself or buffer herself from this act of regicide. I don't know. I just, her motivations and exactly how controlling she is over Lancel, I think, remains a really kind of fascinating open question in this chapter.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to read my synopsis, and we can sort of jump into these details.
Great.
Tyrion is visited by Lancel late at night. The newly knighted boy brings word from Circe. By the Queen Regent's decree, Tyrion must release Pycelle from the Black Cells and arrest Commander Bywater for treason. Tyrion turns the tables on Lancel by uncovering his part in Robert's death. Lancel begs for mercy and promises to spy on Circe so long as Tyrion doesn't tell Joffrey. Feeling his oats, Tyrion sneaks through the brothel and rides to the manse for a rendezvous with Shay. So, Phil Haberkern, you have the floor. What do you want to talk about today?
You already touched on one of the main things, which is not just the question of who has power in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the relationship between power and authority? And how do we see those things sort of interacting both within this moment and then more broadly in the characters of Tyrion and Circe?
Let's define some terms here. So what would you say is the difference between power and authority?
Oh my gosh, this is my favorite question to ask my students, but I usually don't have to answer it myself.
I would love to hear your answer to the question of the difference between power and authority.
No, so I'd say, like, on the most basic level, if I have power, it means that I can punch you in the face, right? I can exert my will against somebody else. I can do the thing I want to do. But if I have authority, I convince all the people around, and maybe even you, that I had the right to punch him in the face, right? So power is often like, again, it's personal, it is coercive, whereas authority, there's an aspect of sort of social recognition, right? Like you are granted authority by others, even as you make a claim to it yourself. Whereas power, you can take, and it's likely not to be permanent. There are limitations on that, but it's about the ability to do what you want versus the recognition that what you are doing is legitimate.
So there's like a social construct around who has the right to do what, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, so much of the second of Clash of Kings is about who can claim the authority of the Iron Throne. And how do you reconcile these very, you know, obviously conflicting sort of zero-sum game claims to the throne? And you see, you know, the strategies to undermine someone else's authority with rumor and slander versus, you know, within the context of King's Landing in the same way, you know, Tyrion is trying to figure out what power do I have? How do I gain more authority? Varys and Littlefinger are doing the same thing. I think Cersei, as she's depicted, has a little bit, maybe less of a nuanced sense of the distinction, but that's, I don't know, that's maybe a bigger question to address.
So there's an analog to this little exchange between Tyrion and Lancel when the king's men come with a decree, they're looking for Gendry, and they confront Yoren and say, we have something, we have this piece of paper.
That's right.
The king has declared that that these hostages come with us, or these men come with us. And Yoren basically says, screw you. The Night's Watch has, you know, we're non-political. We don't recognize that piece of paper. And then, of course, my question was, well, who has sort of the legal right to this?
Oof.
And I guess, I mean, the person I was talking with during that chapter was basically saying, it kind of depends where you are, you know, and because the social construct is going to change dramatically the farther you get north.
Absolutely.
So I guess the question is, you know, I guess at that moment, because it's a war happening, it's like, well, maybe who has the most men and who has the most swords and horses and whatnot.
Right, because that's how that micro conflict sort of resolves, right? Like everybody rallies around Yoren and Gendry, as opposed to, you know, later on when we have the death of Yoren, where it's a numbers game and it's about power. Yeah. Authority is not at issue.
Right. In this case, Lancel comes in. On the surface, he has everything going for him, right? He's sleeping with the queen. So he has the queen's backing. He has a piece of paper that basically has lent royal authority to the action. He's been knighted. He's taller. And he has a sword. And Tyrion, you know, Tyrion's a, you know, shorter man. He has no sword. He's not been knighted. I guess, I mean, he has the title Hand of the King, right?
Yep.
But on paper, he should absolutely yield to this decree by the Queen Regent. And yet, because he's got a little bit of information and he knows how to use it to his advantage, he is absolutely able to seize all of the power in the room. So here's an example where the authority is actually less important than the power.
Correct. And but then the source of the power isn't what we think it should be. And I think that's sort of a central tension or a central area for exploration through all of, you know, Game of Thrones or Song of Ice and Fire, is how do people who are denied conventional forms of power use their available resources to gain it? And, you know, Tyrion is a classic example. Varys, Baelish, Cersei, every woman except maybe Daenerys, because the dragons are a pretty good vehicle for power. But at least early on, Daenerys, like we see all of these characters trying to get past the sort of military, noble, masculine power structures of the society and find the sort of spaces within it that they can exploit because of information, because of coin, because of sex. And over and over, we see characters, you know, using their best features, I guess we might say, the characteristics that they can leverage to subvert the power structure that looks monolithic, but over and over in the course of the books. And this scene is a great microcosm. If it's a monolith, it's on crumbling foundations, right? And I think that's my favorite part, I think, of the books.
Okay, so like I said, I always love Tyrion chapters. And but there are Tyrion chapters that kind of go broad. And what I mean by broad is that you get a bit more of Tyrion's past, or, you know, something happens in the chapter that opens up possibility for the future, or you get a bit of world building, right? Those are all sort of aspects that can broaden the story. And then there's chapters that go deep. This is, for me, it's an example of a chapter that absolutely goes deeper than it than anything else. And it goes deep in a way that allows you to see that Tyrion may be the happiest he's ever been in his life. He feels like he's over Tysha. He's like a fish in water in King's Landing. He feels like he's really good at being Hand of the King. And he has, I think, and maybe I should ask you this, I really get the sense that he has fallen in love with Shay.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it just almost delusional, blissful love, right?
It seems that way.
And as this chapter ends, it's almost like this guy has never been happier. And because of that, I'm worried.
I was trying to, as I went back to this chapter, I was trying to, you know, remember reading it for the first time, because I 100% agree with you that, like, this is the apogee of Tyrion's happiness. But I like you, finished the chapter with a sense of foreboding, because, you know, nothing ends well in this world. But I was trying to recall the first time I read it. You know, did I think it was going to work out? Did I think that the story was, you know, this unlikely second son rises to the top by his wits and, you know, the love of, as we'd say, you know, for sort of contemporary film, you know, the hooker with a heart of gold and the sellsword who suddenly has found his loyalty. And I bet I did. I think looking back, I probably was like, yes, this storyline rules. Tyrion's going to win, which feels about as naive as maybe Tyrion is in this moment, but I'm with you. It feels like this is the top of the mountain for him.
Yeah. And it feels delusional. It feels completely delusional. I mean, at one point he tells himself, I'm over Tysha, which of course is, I think he's lying to himself. He, you know, I don't need Tysha. I don't need any other woman. I just need Shay. And then you get this little detail that, like, he's employed guards at the manse who are ugly men so that he doesn't have to be jealous of them. And then he kind of, like, little bit of moment of self-reflection. He's like, I guess I'm an ugly man, but maybe Shay doesn't even see ugliness. And I'm just sitting there, like, face in palm, like thinking, oh no, why you're so smart. You're so smart. And yet when it comes to women, you are such a fool. You know, maybe Shay doesn't see ugliness, right? This is a live possibility in Tyrion's mind.
Yeah, but I mean, this goes back. I mean, like, he's just such a traumatized figure in the books, not just from Tysha, but just from a childhood without love, that any seeming source of love and affection, you can see him sort of gravitating towards it so strongly. And so, even though, you know, this chapter has this sort of antagonistic relationship between Cersei and Tyrion, you go back to their previous encounter where they're just dying of laughter over, you know, Stannis and Renly going to war with each other. And, you know, even in that moment, he so quickly slips into what feels like legitimate, like, fraternal affection for Cersei.
Well, and also again, in the chapter previous to that, Cersei is legitimately wounded and cries at the thought of Myrcella being married off like she was.
That's right.
And Tyrion kind of reaches out to try to comfort her. So you almost see that these two have a history together and they don't entirely hate each other.
No. And again, I think it's just, I mean, for him, I would psychologize it as like, there is a need for love and precious few places it might come from. I'm trying to think, I feel like maybe there are moments too with his brother where you see that legitimate affection and concern for each other strongly. So it's not just with women, but it does feel like he's more likely to seek it from that source.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that relationship a little bit, because so we were talking about, you know, like the hand of the king is a legit mm-hmm. authority and the queen regent is a legit authority. And then, you know, what happens if they disagree on something? But in addition to that, the people who occupy those offices are brother and sister.
Yes.
Which means that sort of overshadowing the chapter is Tywin.
Mm-hmm.
Because if these two have a dispute, it's almost like, I'm going to tell Dad, you know. So you have that element. It's like, well, it's not just that I'm going to kill you. It's that I'm going to have to go and explain this to my father and have him rule between us. And here's a, you know, here's a lord in the kingdom who does not have the office,
mm-hmm.
but absolutely has the power over these two.
And I would say authority as well. You know, he is recognized as the most fearsome, competent, capable, ruthless sort of figure, arguably in the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, he's the most dangerous guy in the book, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question is, why does Cersei send Lancel? You know, because this could have happened. This could have happened in any other room. It could have happened at any other time of day. Cersei decides, I'm going to send the 16-year-old recently knighted cousin to bring this document to my brother. What does she think that Lancel will do that she can't do? Or does she want Lancel to succeed? I don't understand this.
Oh, that's such an interesting question. Because I think I read it on almost like a simpler level, which is that it's a miscalculation. And that not just as a plot device, but the idea that she is so certain of her authority and power in this moment as Queen Regent,
mm-hmm.
that she hears about Pycelle, she reacts instinctively, he is in her chambers, and she sends him as quickly as possible as a sort of demonstration that it is she who rules and Tyrion who serves. But in doing so, that sort of impulsive decision allows Tyrion to flip the script.
Yeah.
And so I guess I hadn't thought as much about, maybe because Lancel seems like such a poor tool. You know what I mean? I mean, like what could he... I have a hard time imagining her thinking he could intimidate Tyrion. Surely she knows better than that.
Yeah. All right. So here's a, all right. So you're talking about the previous chapter where they are face to face and mm-hmm. she slaps him.
Yes.
And there's a male female power dynamic there
mm-hmm.
where Tyrion's basically saying, Marcella's a princess. She was born specifically to be married off. That is mm-hmm. her primary purpose. That is her value. And so it's not just that he's brother hand of the king. It's that he's a male.
Yes.
And Cersei is female.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that maybe Cersei is hoping to avoid that particular dynamic for this particular exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I mean, to reinforce that dynamic, I do think that in this case, Tywin's going to side with his son over his daughter, but maybe I've got that wrong.
No, I think when you think about the political ramifications of Tyrion's strategy, it works, right? Like it accomplishes the goal, and it's too successful in terms of securing Dorne, or at least sidelining yeah. Dorne, that it's, I, yes, Tywin is going to agree. And I certainly must know, not must know, I think she knows that she's been outmaneuvered around her daughter. And so she has this moment of protest, this sort of moment of fury, that this fate which she had hoped to avoid for her daughter, to leverage her position as regent to protect her daughter from sort of being, you know, sort of a trade bait in the realm of politics. But she can't. And so there's this moment where she exercises herself physically against Tyrion, who's probably one of the only men in her life against which she can do that.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
She has a physical advantage over him. And yet, you know, this, maybe it's the lingering anger, maybe it's a sense of her own security or primacy in this moment. But it, again, I've always read or watched this decision as a sort of a miscalculation, a moment of impulsivity, of anger at Tyrion, trumping her own political sense.
I mean, one possibility is that Cersei knows what's going to happen if Lancel goes and confronts Tyrion, that she'll end up having a sort of a double agent on her hands. And then maybe she can manipulate information flow to Tyrion.
True.
But I almost feel like that's giving Cersei a bit too much credit. It feels like the character that I've met so far on these pages is more likely to miscalculate in a moment of bad decision making. I'm not sure if I'm missing something here, but I think it probably is more plausible that this is a miscalculation than it is a strategic move.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting because I mean I don't know, you've spent a lot of time talking about these books in great detail.
Yeah.
But I always get the feeling that Martin as an author is almost most conflicted about Cersei among all of his characters.
Oh, interesting. Say more about that.
On the one hand, you know, here she is. She's this capable woman who's thwarted at every turn by her father and her brothers and the demands made against her gender and a boorish husband and a one terrible son and two seemingly pretty good kids. And so she's hemmed in and pushing back against it and is often very articulate about, you know, if only I'd been born a male, I wouldn't have to deal with all this shit. But on the flip side, she is impulsive and she is vengeful and she totally sanctions the sort of long-term torture of Sansa. Uh-huh. And so there are all those aspects of her that are deeply, deeply sort of hateful. So in some ways, I find myself in moments almost sort of adopting Cersei's point of view or trying to actually build some empathy for her as a character. And then she turns around and does something like this. And I have this sort of whiplash towards her in a way there aren't that many other individuals, I think, in the story for whom my feelings, I think, are getting yo-yoed back and forth quite the same way.
Well, all right. So set in contrast, I mean, one way to look at this is everyone in the story, including Cersei, thinks I am Jaime Lannister, born female.
Yes.
Right. And of course, Jaime is limited in a number of ways. Right.
Yes.
He's got all the privilege in the world, like literally all of the privilege in the world. And yet he is impulsive. He will let his sort of momentary lapse of judgment create problems for himself. You know, he's not the kind of guy who's going to be patient and wait to see what someone else does before he makes a move.
Right.
And normally he can sort of fight his way out of that situation. So, you know, if Cersei is that person born female.
Right.
Then I guess it's an interesting exploration of what would Jaime look like if he didn't have all of that privilege, right?
Or maybe a slight spin on that is that besides all of the privilege of position and wealth and everything else that sort of comes with his political identity, you know, it's Jaime's physicality that sets him apart, right? His ability to be the best at the skill that is seen as the height.
Yeah.
He's not just a male.
He's like the ideal male.
He's the ideal. And so do we flip that to say then, and here again, we see it, that for Cersei, like the height of physicality, like physical perfection for females in this world is that seductive aspect.
Right.
But here again, potentially an impulsive decision to start a relationship with your cousin to manipulate him through this thing that has worked for you in the past, having sort of disastrous consequences, because all of a sudden now, you know, you basically fought your way out of one thing to get into a bigger fight. And it feels like she's done the same thing, except, you know, so it's an interesting, as you say, like, if they are mirror images of each other, that tracks to some extent.
Yeah. Jaime is going to jump into the fray with his sword in hand and just fight his way out. But of course, Cersei's sword is her body.
Exactly. And the power that wields over other people.
That's fantastic. Now, you know, this, of course, we're going to compare her to her other brother in this chapter, because she clearly makes a misstep. Tyrion is going to, it's almost such a clear and decisive victory that he almost wants to crow about it.
Yes.
And the second best thing he can do besides crow is to like go celebrate with his lover. And yet you see this guy at the height of his power completely reveal in his interior that he has this glaring weakness. He's got this fatal flaw, and it has to do with if he thinks a woman loves him, he will completely lose all of his strategic ability. He'll lose all of his senses. He will jump head over heels and the consequences be damned or whatever.
Absolutely.
And so this kind of foreshadows like, oh no, we actually see in this chapter your fatal flaw, and the way that Martin writes, of course, this is going to have a massive consequence for this character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think in some ways too, you know, obviously both the books and the shows are vivid in the way they depict and describe sex. But the end of this chapter is, to me, even among many other options, like it is particularly explicit.
Yeah, there's a couple chapters like that in this book, but this one was like, it was a bit over the top.
It's a bit over the top, but I would read that as this is Tyrion getting to celebrate his own physicality and his ability in this case to please someone in a way that like he really doesn't get to, right? Like he is physically weak. This is a moment of celebration and of asserting his physical ability.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. It is quite over the top in what we might see as a sort of unnecessary way. But I mean, I think it's meant to reflect what you're saying, what you said earlier, this idea of like, this is the happiest he's ever been. He has this like surge of the feeling. He says it. I have all the power. I have the city. I have the girl.
Yeah.
He is claiming things. And
he feels so powerful. He can even overcome his physical deficit in this moment.
Absolutely. And I also think it's crucial, and if this doesn't make it into the podcast, because it's a little like, I think it's creepy in the book, but like the fact that she's asleep matters.
Yeah.
Because I think there's this idea that there's no faking. There's no artifice. As soon as she wakes up, she says the perfect thing, you know, to absolutely stroke his ego in the way that he needs it. But I think this idea, but like I said, that's maybe is a step too far. So,
well, not only that is that she's young and he notes that, you know, he notes that she is young, and this sort of makes her even more perfect in his eyes. And so there's all kinds of problems that are presented for this character who we love, who we absolutely love, And I think, you know, if in so much as a book like this can have a main character, Tyrion is the main character.
I think so. Rereading it, like in preparation for this, it is clear he is sort of supposed to be our avatar in some ways. Like he is our guide to this world and he's walking us through, you know, all of these sort of machinations. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe not totally identify with him, but we are certainly supposed to like him.
Yeah. So, all right. So that's interesting to me. What is the fascination with Tyrion? Like, why are we drawn to Tyrion? He is something of an unlikely hero in a lot of ways. And yet there's something about him always being in this one down position, but almost being always the smartest guy in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the fascination with Tyrion, do you think? Why do we want to like Tyrion?
Most of us are probably not confident in our ability to put on plate armor and swing a sword and not get immediately killed. So again, I think the prevalent sort of value system of Westerosi society is so sort of toxically, militantly masculine that I think we push back a little bit against it. Then the other people who might sort of champion alternative positions, like Littlefinger, you know, they are too conniving. You know, Davos Seaworth is the other character who I think obviously invites our sympathy and empathy throughout. As another, you know, he's a fundamentally decent person watching a terrible thing unfold around him that he feels unable to control. So he's an interesting second. And then, you know, I think it's also this book really decenters Robb Stark, who might be the other person we could identify
with. That's interesting.
But he's not as big of a character. I'm trying to remember how many, you know, like we see him more through his mother's eye.
Mm.
So I think it's kind of a, who else are we supposed to identify with? And, you know, we might trick ourselves into being the smartest people in the room, but we're unlikely, at least I am, to trick myself into thinking I'm the strongest or the fastest or anything like that. Hmm. So
this is sort of undermined in this chapter, but I feel like with so many other characters in this book, their perspective is so limited. It's like you're looking at the world through Bran's eyes. And of course, Bran has the limitations of a child's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Or Theon lacks a certain self-awareness.
Yes.
You can kind of get a more self-aware perspective from Kat, but, you know, we've only seen a couple Kat chapters. You know, here we are, Tyrion, this is his seventh POV. Kat only has two at this point.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So, I mean, you've got a lot of these other characters, but I think almost always you just imagine that Tyrion has outthought the other person in the room.
Yes.
And so you feel like you get a little bit more of the story revealed from his perspective than maybe you would another character.
I think that's right, because he's trying to balance so many different perspectives to maintain this sort of tentative grasp on power that he's gotten himself, right? Mm-hmm. He needs to be deeply concerned about his father and what his father wants and about Lannister military success in the field. He needs to be aware of what's going on with Stannis. Mm. He needs to know how Stannis and Renly's conflict is going. He needs to keep one eye on his brother and how he might free him, but also another eye on his sister, plus the small council and the kingdom's finances and forging a giant chain and wildfire. You know, he's got the most balls in the air.
Right.
And is very articulate about not so much the strain that puts on him, but the fact that he is aware that he's juggling all of these things in a way that I think you're totally right. Other POV characters in this book are so focused on what's immediately in front of them.
Mm.
And he never is.
Well, and he's almost an avatar for the modern mind because he is so cynical about things. He's not overly religious. He's, you know, he kind of sees through all of the chivalric nonsense, which I think is sort of one of the key themes of the book.
Mm-hmm.
He's funny, you know. That goes yes. a long way.
That helps. No, that's really interesting about like the cynicism or at least the realism about what's going on. And again, like how that forces you to take certain actions and not just, you know, over and against religion or chivalry or the sort of knightly ethic yeah. of the kingdom. Is he real? Is he enough of a realist or cynic that he even pushes back on the notion of family loyalty?
I don't know, because he is very much a Lannister.
Right.
In so much as that, like, he's going to work his ass off to make sure the Lannister name is on top at the end, even to the point that he's going to support a boy king who's a moral monster. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird because we're rooting for Tyrion, but what is Tyrion working for? Tyrion's working to keep Joffrey on the throne.
Yeah.
We all hate Joffrey so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little odd. It's a little odd to hooray Tyrion, you know.
So that's interesting then that he's able to shake, or we identify him as shaking certain sort of cultural constraints uh-huh. that are at work in this world, but the family piece of it, he can't. The people who, you know, in some ways, particularly his father, have been the worst to him.
Yeah.
For whom he has no real reason to love. As you say, for a nephew who is, you know, worse than a White Walker.
Yeah.
And yet he's struggling for that.
Uh-huh.
And how do we preserve this? I don't know. That's a really interesting.
He's a fascinating, complicated character. And he's, you know, let's just call it out. He will eventually murder Shay.
Yeah.
After this chapter, he loves her, or at least loves the idea of her or something. He's convinced himself that he loves her.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh man.
And she's going to betray him, or at least that's how he's going to perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to strangle her to death. And for some weird, bizarre, mystical reason, we're still gonna root for him. we're still gonna forgive him and want the best for him in the end, and hope he can find happiness.
That's wild to think about, because he's also gonna burn a bunch of people to death with a clever ruse in Blackwater Bay. I mean, he's not a good person, and. Perhaps that's the other piece of it.
You mentioned Davos. We love Davos. He's going to kill all of Davos' sons.
Poor Davos. I love that guy. But it's also, I mean, maybe one of the other reasons is he has no illusions about being a good person.
Uh-huh.
You know, he is pretty clear about what he is capable of from a relatively early stage. Uh-huh. And, you know, this idea of sort of self-preservation or familial preservation is a primary motivation for him. And maybe there's a little recognition of that again in those last lines about his self-recognition about how much he loves, you know, playing this political game, but winning this political game. And that becomes, you know, Shay is part of it. She's a sort of spoil of war in some sense for him. But
she's literally a sex worker who he found the night before a battle.
Exactly. So Martin's ability to make us sustain our investment in terrible people, you know, is one of his great gifts as an author. Yeah.
Fantastic. So notable introductions in this chapter. We hear about Moray, I guess that's how you say her mm-hmm. name, who has silver hair and alabaster skin, and who can read. And initially I thought, ooh. is this a Targaryen?
Targaryen offshoot?
Yeah. Like, interesting. Like it's a very odd combination.
Yeah.
Not violet eyes, but green eyes. So, you know, not perfect, but it did kind of call my attention here. And then of course, another sex worker, Dancy.
Mm-hmm.
Dancy. Notable differences. In the show, it didn't have any sort of brothel subterfuge where he, like, sneaks up to into a room and then goes mm-hmm. down a, you know, secret hatchway and finds Shay in a different part of the city.
Right.
All of that is a book only detail. I think in the show, she's just hanging out in his bedroom the whole time.
Right. And we also don't have the whole sort of Jace by water is not a factor.
Yeah, that's right.
In the show either, which that's fine. Let's simplify the narrative a little bit.
Right. Notable departures in the chapter. No notable departures unless it's like Lancel's pride. Lancel loses his pride utterly in this chapter.
Yes, he does.
Poor Lancel. And you know, Tyrion, we were talking about, you know, whether he's a moral person. He knows that Lancel is likely to die.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, it could happen either that Jaime comes back, just kills the boy, or it could be that Cersei finds out that he's spying for me and she kills the boy. And then he says something like, probably Cersei. But he's almost kind of resolved to the fact that the move that he just made that he's so excited about will result in his cousin's death.
But I think I would say Tyrion was already convinced that Lancel was going to die. I mean, imagine being caught between Joffrey, Cersei, Jaime, and Tywin, you know, which his actions of sleeping with his cousin. Right. Like, he has put himself there already, and Lancel is not that smart.
He's 16 years old. I forgot.
Right.
That.
Like, how is he possibly going to sort of keep this? You know, Varys already knows. So, I think Tyrion probably sees himself as earning a benefit from his death, but not causing his death.
And then, last thing I was going to mention is that we have actual confirmation about Cersei and Lancel's involvement in Robert's death.
Yes.
Which we kind of knew already because Varys told us, but to have Lancel kind of spill the tea directly, you know, he's conveying something that he knows from personal involvement. It kind of confirms what we thought we knew, at least.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because there's this kind of deflection that's going on of, you know, I just gave him the wine.
Yeah.
The strong wine. Yeah. I didn't do anything.
She told me to do it.
She told me to do it. Well, Tywin told me to do what she said. She said, give him the wine.
Tyrion's lying, I guess, like, oh, did he also tell you to fuck her?
Is that... oh my God.
he has absolutely no chance.
Well, and it's fascinating because, you know, again, here he is. I'm with you. Like, he is, you know, ha ha ha, been thrown in the lion's den. But, you know, he has a sweet voice. He has a terrible mustache. You know, he's just this kid. And yet, you know, he's always sneering. He's always adopting this sort of certain attitude. And again, with just those few details, I don't feel particularly sympathetic towards Lancel. Maybe I should.
Well,
but it's very deft.
It's one of these situations where this guy's in an impossible situation. He's been told to do certain things by very evil people. Now he's in too deep, and he's way over, you know, and Tyrion's mind is just going to think circles around his, right? So you should feel a little bit of sympathy for him, but nope.
And I think it comes back to Tyrion's perspective, right? Because Tyrion has been having to put up with, you know, doofuses like this for his entire life, who because they're sir and because they have a sword, he can't do this. He can't, there's no comeuppance. And like, now is the time he can flex and sort of exert his power over this kid.
I think something shifts when Lancel calls him imp. I think there's something like, okay, all right, here it comes.
You have sealed your fate. So it's again, I think there's, as you said earlier, and I don't think I had kind of run the numbers in my head of how powerfully Tyrion's point of view shapes this book. But you're right, and it's in some sense it's just that ubiquity that sort of pushes us into his camp, where we see Lancel's one more arrogant knight making fun of the little guy. Until
he's almost a stand-in for every young, brash, tall, blonde knight who is called Tyrion an imp.
Yeah, you might see that as in a lesser degree. There's a sort of parallel there to Theon, you know, who's becoming sort of a little bit more of a voice throughout this book of another person who's going to be all of these assumptions about privilege and power and suddenly getting humbled in an unexpected way.
That's right. That's right.
By his family.
Phil, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, certainly my pleasure.
I want to say it's a sort of a glorious Tyrion chapter, but it's hard not to see that little tinge of tragedy.
No, it's coming. Yeah. And again, it's so hard to go back to that. I was actually, I think in one of the episodes, you know, so I started reading these in 1997.
Oh, really?
So I was like an early adopter of the books. And I just, you know, 25 years later, it's so hard to remember. Was I full of dread and foreboding as he's having this sort of really lovely end to his evening? Or, you know, did I really think he was going to come out on top? And I expect it was the latter. But man, coming back to it, I had a sinking feeling in my stomach as I finished the chapter.
Oh, goodness. Phil, fantastic. What a fun conversation.
Very low maintenance. Absolutely. This is great. And because I'm, you know, not thinking about it right now, but at some point later this summer, I will start thinking about teaching, because I'm teaching the Game of Thrones class again in the fall. So I'll turn my head back to Thrones and I'll circulate it among my students and they'll hopefully get a kick out of it.
Oh, good.
So yeah, but this was great. I enjoyed it. And it's fun to go back. I haven't reread the books in a while, I hadn't reread Clash of Kings in a while. So it's kind of fun to go back and
it really is. This second book is just, I mean, I love the first book too.
But yes.
The second book is just masterful.
It's really good. But what's so funny is you're going back to it. There's so much of the book where not much is actually happening. You know, there's just a lot of conversation and like the way it builds expectation and foreboding. And you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, and you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting. And then the smoke monster shows up, or the shadow monster. And you're like, oh man, this rips. Like, so that was the, you know, just that slow build. He's so good at it. He's so good at it. Oh.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
If you were on the fence with Joffrey, I feel like, I mean, not that I can imagine there were a lot of people that were, but this is sort of the...
It's always the handsome ones that turn into devils.
Yeah, I mean, that was bothersome. I mean, obviously.
Bronn and Tyrion are really underestimating how monstrous Tyrion or Joffrey really is.
Yeah, and so that was what I was kind of wondering too, because is Tyrion going to be taken aback? Like, oh, I had no idea he was like this. This takes me as a surprise, or was this like, okay, now I know? Like, was it with Tyrion? I feel like everything is a touch of an experiment.
Yeah, that's right. I think so.
And so it kind of feels
the
like,
way he plays Lancel, he plays Lancel like a fiddle.
Oh yeah, that's great.
He, I mean, he from start to finish, Lancel's just no match.
No, not even at the end with the let's drink. Oh, you don't have a cup. He just closes the door on. I was like, that such a mic drop moment at that point.